The following is intended for mature audiences only. Discretion is advised.
Thank you so much for downloading this episode of So What Do You Really Do? The podcast where I, your host, Dead Air Dennis Mallon, talks to artists and entertainers about their day jobs. And the artist and entertainer whose day job we're talking about today on the program is Kiki Anderson, also known as Kelly Anderson, who's a reporter and a comedian, former reporter, Baltimore area, WBFF-TV news anchor. She was an anchor. She was on-the-spot reporting. She's now turned to comedy and has moved to L.A. And we talk about, we open right up with how Kiki and I met, which, spoiler alert, we have not met. I would listen to her as a guest on a mutual friend's podcast. I was like, how do we not know each other? We'll go through all of that in the beginning of the podcast because she's on a short list of people who are somebody that's a guest on the podcast, is not a pandemic friend, and somebody who I don't know. So I think it was a very good, fun, interesting conversation with somebody, two people living parallel lives, getting to know each other, and we talk heavily about Baltimore. I may have said a few things about Baltimore that I might even want to retract, but hey, I'm in charge of editing and I left it all in. So I'm okay with you knowing my opinions about the inner workings of the Baltimore City politics and police departments. At least my opinion of them, at least. I don't know how true those inner workings are, but as the recording of this is just before Christmas, by the time you hear this, I have already left Boston for the winter. I'm going to do some winter birding outside of the New England area. When I finish this introduction and the edit of this podcast, I'm going to be packing up everything I'm going to need for 2 months. I'm going to load it into a car, drive down to Baltimore, spend the holidays with my family. And then in the new year, I'm going to make one of two decisions. I'm either going to stay in Baltimore for another couple weeks and then come back to Boston, or I'm going to get in a brand new car that I bought, not brand new, a new to me car that I will be buying. And if all works out, which I'm going to tell you right now, not looking like it's going to work out. I'm putting this plan out there in hopes that it's going to work out. I don't think it's going to. It's a finance. All right, here's the thing. All right, here's where we're at. Boston Duck Tour season is over. I have 3 months of furlough. I go back to talking about the city of Boston as the character UK Lee for Boston Duck Tours in mid to late March, early April. I think the season starts officially April 1st or the first weekend of April, however that works out. And in that time being, what I wanted to, my anticipation of taking this job at Boston Duck Tours was to save up enough money to buy a car and live in LA for a month. I didn't save enough money to do that. At least when I'm looking at the money, I don't think I have enough money to do it. I might have enough money to do it, but if I do, there's no safety net. There's no nest egg. There's no savings. There's no money available if anything goes horribly wrong. I didn't save up as much money as I wanted to because of reasons. Things happen, you know, best laid plans of mice, as Douglas Adams would say. Unfortunately, did not go as well as planned. And so, yeah, I was really looking forward to spending a month in L.A. Weekend in L.A. That's a Scott song. Anyway, the madness. All right. Sorry. It's disappointing. I'm not making as much money on unemployment as I was expecting. That put a damper on things. So, you know, January, February, we're going to be, I'm not going to be in Boston. I don't want to be in Boston for January and February because of the weather. And just also, I don't want to be here. I just want to get out. I want to go somewhere. If that's spending 6 to 8 weeks in Baltimore with my family, I love you, Mom. But if that, and then doing the Maryland, D.C. scene and doing some, maybe getting up to Philly, maybe getting around in the, I can't want to do something warm in January, February. I want to get away from the cold. It's still cold in Maryland. But anyway, so that's what we're planning. I'm going to be in the Mid-Atlantic area for the holidays come New Year, and we're going to figure out what adventures my dog, who is named Sister, and I can get ourselves into in the new year. I'm hoping it's a drive across country and drive back, but doesn't that look like that's going to be it? But, you know, I do have a show December 30th at the Church of Satire in Hanover, Pennsylvania. That information you can find out at deadairdennis.com. As for the new year, who knows? We'll figure it out. I am also doing March 1st and 2nd. I'll be up in the woods of New Hampshire doing shows at Kathleen's in Bristol, New Hampshire. And I have another show. All that information is at deadairdennis.com. If in the emergence of spring in the first weekend of March, if you want to come see me do comedy, I can tell you confidently that's where I'll be doing comedy. So we'll figure it out. Between everything between now and then is unplanned, which makes me very nervous, but also is something I need. I don't do spontaneity. Spontaneity is a good thing sometimes. We'll figure these things out. And by spontaneity, I mean I will do a short-term plan on something. I'll figure out something to do, and then I'll make a very short-term plan to get from the concept of the idea to the actual idea. There'll be a short planning period. I have to plan. I have to put organization together. It's just in my bones. But anyway, that's where I'm at right now talking to you. You are tuning in because I have an interesting guest that I started introducing. This is a fun talk. I say that I did no research. I totally did research. I still, backed around, checked on things so I could talk to my guest. She's very funny. She's witty. She was a delight to talk to. She had an interesting background. And honestly, she says that her mentor in college told her that she was destined for bigger things than local news, and that person was correct. She's an amazingly funny comedian. I'm sure she was a damn fine journalist. I don't know, never watched her in the 10 years that I was away from Baltimore is when she was doing her journalism, working for a local Baltimore news station. But I can tell, I can hear I've read her writings, and I can tell the passion in her voice that she's not just a, pretty face that goes out and like, okay, and here is the story that is now developing. No, she's a outgoing person that can hold a conversation and has intelligence. And I think it was very obvious to me when I started listening to her on my friend Dawn Brody's podcast, Health, that I was like, this is an interesting person that has a lot of similar ties to me that crosses over a lot of things into the same world that I am. We need to talk and we need to be friends. And I'm so glad that she came on the podcast and told me her story and it's going to be telling you the life of someone who goes from being a journalist to being a comedian and the trials and tribulations that have happened to her in between the idea of going, this is what I'm going to be and I am now it. So it's a fun conversation. I hope you enjoy listening to my interview with news reporter and comedian Kiki Anderson.
This podcast is for learning.
We could do a whole episode about the intricacy of ska if you want, because it is my favorite subject. Congratulations. You, Kiki, have the honor of being on a very small list of people that I, invited to be a guest on the podcast, to have never met in person, and is not a pandemic friend.
Well, it's an honor.
You are in a very small list of people that I have no previous experience with whatsoever, so it's going to be a fun conversation getting to know who you are without having any little bit of information. Like, I'm very good at doing, research and, prep work and all that stuff, and there was a small part of me that was like, nope. I'm going to find everything out about you in this conversation because I'm surprised that we don't know each other.
Yeah, we really do walk in a very similar circle. But, this is the better way to do it, I think. This is like pre-internet time. This is vintage of us.
Oh, I mean, I grew up in the 90s, so I knew what it was like to research somebody, outside of the having the internet, just like...
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it's a lie. There was no researching. It was like, if their name's not written in a book at the library, you're fucked. You can't figure
out. Yeah, I was wondering. I'm like, what do you mean by that? Like, did you interview other people? Did you talk to my mother before this?
So, yeah, I mean, the reason I came across you is our friend, Dawn Brody, hosts a podcast, HILF, History I Like to Fuck with Dawn Brody. You were a guest
on
it.
Great podcast, great woman.
She is on that other list of people I have yet to meet in person, but is a pandemic friend.
Love that.
Her and I met through doing Zoom shows through Flappers during the pandemic, which, I mean, she's a vibrant and big personality on the internet. When you're just like in a Zoom room with her, I can't imagine how big her personality actually is when you're in the same room with her, which hopefully I'll find out sooner or later next time I visit LA. But
yeah, I hope you're that lucky. She's great. Big fan.
So she does a quick background on who her guest is, about the history topic they're talking about. And I'm listening to, I was like, from Baltimore, worked in news, is a comedian. I looked your name up and was like, we have a ton of mutual friends. How have we not crossed paths? Like, there's even people where it's like, I just recognize your profile, their profile pic, just because it shows up in the people you may know section a lot, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But so let's start with the Baltimore thing, because born and raised in Baltimore, now living in Boston the past 10 years. It's surprising that we never crossed paths before I left for Boston 10 years ago when I was doing comedy in Baltimore. Are you born and raised native Baltimorean?
No. So I'm actually from Silver Spring. I was born in D.C., raised in Montgomery County.
The DMV, MoCo. Yeah. I mean, they're all kind of the same. To me, they're all the same because I grew up in Baltimore and I went to school in a college in MoCo and I worked in D.C., for iHeartRadio, DC 101, Hot 99.5, all of those.
We're all in the family. It's a little trip down the highway.
Silver Spring's 35 minutes. Trust me, I drove it 6 days a week. I know how exactly far it is.
Yeah.
Especially time by taking 108 to Olney and all the way through that. But that's just me throwing my DMV knowledge out there to prove that I know my
You passed the test, you know? Well, it's so funny because once in a while I'll run into people from here that before they tell me where they're from, I'll be like, I'm from DC, and they'll be like, oh really, I'm from Southeast. I'm like, all right, fine, I'm from fucking Silver Spring. You caught me, Jesus. But I was born in DC, so that is a point of pride.
Okay, so you were born in a hospital in DC and then lived in the Silver Spring area. Like, I mean this will tell you everything you need to know about me, is that I'm from Dundalk. So it's like, I still
Scott
say Baltimore.
Thief.
Like, yeah, it's Baltimore. It's the county, but let's be honest, it's still Balmer City. But I went to college at Montgomery College in Rockville. Mm-hmm. I went for a television radio program. Like, I've been in the media, entertainment, journalism thing my entire life. Like, I went to a school that was an art school. This was a path for me at a young age. I picked Montgomery County because they had a civil engineering class or program, and I was going to be a civil engineer. And the day I registered, I was like, nope, TV, radio. I want to be a radio disc jockey. If you can't figure out by this incredibly radio-esque looking podcast studio in my basement of my apartment in Boston.
This is in your house? That's sick.
Yeah. It's stuff that I stole from work when they laid me off in 2018. So... Most of the studio is made up of stolen parts. That's my severance package, iHeartRadio, is this microphone. But I knew this was...
You did good. This is really nice.
Radio was my path. Podcasting was a natural end to all of that. You know, like, to me, radio always intertwined the things that I loved the most, which was music, comedy, and I say news, but I never watched the news, but like that media, entertainment, interviews and stuff like that. I did enjoy listening to Barbara Walters interviews as a kid, and I love listening to my favorite radio disc jockeys do interviews on the air. So I knew I wanted to grow up to be an interviewer, hence a podcast where I interview people. I knew what my path was from a kid. I knew what I wanted to do. Was news, working in the news industry, a thing that you knew at a young age that you wanted to do?
It's kind of like a mixed bag. So my dad was a journalist.
Okay.
So in high school, that was a path that I was like exploring. You know, I got onto the high school paper because I was good at photography, but then I started doing news for the school paper and I found that I was kind of good at it. But at that same time, I found late night and I was like, oh, this is what I want to do. I want to be Jon Stewart. And I didn't know anybody in the comedy world. I didn't know what an improv class was. I didn't know that much about stand-up, to be honest. I had a couple stand-up comedians I really liked. But I didn't know what the path was. I just hoped that eventually, if I followed the news path, I would find my way to the late night world. And so finally, when I moved to Eugene for news first, I went to school in Arizona, then I moved to Eugene for my first job, and I moved All right. back to Baltimore.
Before we get deeper into that timeline, you went to school in Arizona. Why Arizona? Like the reason I picked Montgomery County is an hour away, and it had the program that I wanted. And it allowed me to stay close to my family because my father was suffering from heart attacks and strokes, and he was like needed aid and care. And I didn't want to move away, which really hurt my radio career by never leaving Baltimore or DC.
Yeah.
Why was it that about Arizona State?
Yeah.
I don't know. I went to 6 years of community college and didn't graduate. The college life means nothing to me. I don't know the difference between a state, a university, or any of those other things. I barely know their names. But why?
But you know what, Dennis? It doesn't matter. You don't need a fucking college degree these days. Like, who cares? You know?
Right?
I was lucky. I was lucky that Arizona State ended up being actually the best journalism school in the country. But I would be lying if I said that's why I went there. I knew I wanted to go away. But I couldn't get into any, like, elite East Coast schools because I was a terrible student in high school. So ASU welcomed me with open arms. And I was like, oh, this is fun. It's a party school. It's far away from home. And then it happened to be the best journalism school in the country. I'm like, oh, well, there's a perk. So it all worked out.
You did go to a school for journalism. Like, you said you started with the school paper as a photographer, which, by the way, huge blind spot in my entertainment media world is still photography. Like, taking honestly, all the little letters and symbols on the dial of a camera mean nothing. They might as well be Egyptian hieroglyphics. I have no clue what they mean.
I still am not
on my shoulder. Boom! I know what I'm doing.
Yeah, because you pretty much just hit record, and you know you can put it on auto mode, and you'll be safe. You know, but it's like that with cameras too. I honestly, even now, I shoot comedy shows to pay my bills sometimes, and I still am not like a super expert on how to use a camera. I know the composition of a good photo and lighting, but I still don't know what the fuck I'm doing.
The composition is what matters the most. Is what it at the end of the day, what does that picture look like? And now with Lightroom, Photoshop, you could take the shittiest picture and make it look really good and not have to make it fake artsy, like, oh, I purposely took this out of focus to make it
right
meaningful. No, you could sharpen the fuck out of it. I was just looking at headshots that I had taken the other day where there's still a glare in my glasses. And 10 minutes of a YouTube tutorial never touching Photoshop before that day. I removed some pretty good glare in my glasses and I stopped and went, I'll let somebody else do it because this is too tedious for me. But so you started with photography. You knew you wanted to go in Jersey. You went to Arizona State.
Mm-hmm.
What was the plan after graduating from Arizona State? Because I was fortunate enough that while I was still in college, I had a teacher that was talking to WTNT, in touch with the operations manager at WTNT, an AM right-wing political talk station in the early 2000s. And they're like, he's like, hey, send me, tell your best students to send me a resume. I need to hire board ops. So even before I graduated, I was already working for iHeartRadio. I was working for...
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, I was working for 12 different radio stations at the time as a board op engineer. And then eventually worked my way onto on air, sort of. My story is different.
Yeah, but learning on the back end, I mean, yeah, there's no school like real life experience.
Yeah, there was a point like, why am I even still going to school? I already have the job that I need. The degrees, you're right, are useless. So I had my plan of finish my schooling and just keep working here and working my way up and apply for other jobs. When you graduate from Arizona State with a degree in journalism or media or whatever, public relations, whatever. What was your degree in? Specifically journalism?
My degree was in broadcast journalism and my minor was in anthropology. Never used that a day in my fucking life. I should have minored in like theater. That would have been useful today. But
is there not somebody at these colleges to talk these people out of these like obtuse pairing of majors and minors?
Yeah, I was was such an idiot. I was like, I'm going to feed my brain with knowledge. And there is like merit to that. But yeah, it's called go read a book. Don't go wasting your college degree, your scholarship on a fucking anthropology minor. That's never been useful.
Yeah, like, you know, there's things that, you know, are parallel in paths that you should probably be studying. But
yeah.
So what was the plan? Was it internships? Was it moving around? Like, I learned early in radio that it was, if you want a job, get out of D.C. You're never going to get hired here as a noob. I broke that mold. But.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was actually just reflecting on this because I've done podcast interviews in the past where we talked about, like, the switch from news to comedy and stuff. And I was trying to think, like, what's the deeper story there? And I remember, I mean, I desperately needed a job out of college because I didn't have anybody supporting me. So, you know, my college was cool enough to like set you up with interviews and, you know, get you right onto the news path. But I remember this really distinct conversation with my mentor in college where it was the advice at the right advice at the wrong time. And I could go back in time. I wish maybe I had listened to him more, but I just wasn't ready to receive it. I had this mentor in college named Aaron Brown, who was like a superstar journalist. He was the guy reporting on the Twin Towers falling on CNN, like the day it happened. And like that blew him to stardom. And I think eventually he was replaced by Anderson Cooper, but he was,
that's the person to be replaced by. Like,
yeah,
like,
right?
No offense to your buddy, Aaron, but that's either a lateral or a step up when you're talking about Anderson Cooper. So that's good.
Yeah.
Company
and Anderson Cooper's great. I can't even hate on him. But my mentor was like, you're going to rot doing local news. Like, your dreams are so much bigger. Go knock on the door of NBC. And I'm like, you're crazy. You know, like, you can't go knocking on the door of NBC. They're not going to answer the door. It's not the 60s anymore, you know? But I think the message he was trying to tell me was, you don't have to go on a traditional path. You can dream bigger. Like be a little more fearless, you know, but I had so many like traumatic things happen in college, like between a car accident and my parents got sick and my mom lost her job, that I just wanted some safety. And the safety at that moment was going to work in local news, which was cool in its own way. I would have never seen Oregon or like, I got to be on like the front row seats of America doing local news and experience and learn things that I never would have. And I would never take that experience back, but it was a choice made out of fear. Because I was just scared to free fall after college and not be able to like pay my bills or like get another accident and not have health insurance, you know? So I went into local news and then I did 2 years in Oregon and then I wanted to move closer to home. So I moved to Baltimore and did news there. But when I moved to Baltimore, I was like, I'm going to do comedy. I'm going to find comedy and I'm going to do comedy and I'm going to get on the path that I've always dreamed of. And that's when I started doing stand-up.
Well, when you were in Eugene, did they hire you as producer, copywriter, reporter? What was
reporter.
Your specific job? Reporter. So you went right.
Yeah, I was an MMJ. Reporter. Yeah.
Oh, see, that's a big jump. You know, the only bigger jump would be going from school to anchor. Position, because that's mm-hmm. obviously the much more stable, much more full-time. So I mean, I'm not that well versed with the in and out workings of, you know, getting hired as reporters or photojournalists or any of that. I know people who do those jobs and we, you know, never got into the nitty-gritties of it. But what was your main responsibilities as a journalist in Eugene? Were you doing package news? Were you doing breaking news on the spot? What did they have you do the most?
Well, you know, local news is such a funny, weird, unique little industry where mm-hmm. they throw a 22, 23-year-old to the fire, you know? And because it's a small shop that doesn't have a lot of money, you do all the jobs. So yeah. I was hired as what's called an MMJ, which is basically you're a reporter and your own videographer.
Multimedia
but I also
journalist.
Was, yeah, uh-huh. But I also was an anchor, weathercaster, producer, editor. I did all the jobs and I made $25,000 a year.
That's the one of the reasons why I picked the radio path, because in, you know, when I graduated in 1999, the TV had so much high budgets that people did one specific job. But in radio you had to do everything. Like in radio mm-hmm. you were the host, editor, producer. You had to do all your own stuff. You didn't have a team of people. You know, TV right. always seemed like it was a collaborative effort. And that's one reason why I steered away from TV more into radio in my college years. But it definitely there was a time where, like, I remember the day that New York Times fired all of their photographers and then gave their reporters iPhones and went, here, you're your own photographer now. And they're like, what? You know, so it wow. Was there any of that, like, have learning curve of, look, I learned how to do on-air stuff. I learned how to write. Now I got to figure out how to do a camera. Or were you already in that mindset of, I have to do all the jobs and figure out all the things? Was there a learning curve to trying to figure out how to be a journalist in a small, I don't know what market, 125 or something, Eugene, Oregon?
Yeah, right? It's a small market.
Was there a learning curve?
You do these days learn the basics in college of like how to shoot, how to edit, how to produce, how to everything. But you know, it's trial by fire. My like second week on the job, they sent me to a wildfire, which like I'm from the East Coast. I've never seen a fucking wildfire. They're like, yeah, you go right up to the fire line where shit's burning down. And you try to get the shot. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And they put you live on air, which is its own beast, right? You have to be able to like ad lib and explain what's going on in real time. So you don't know how to talk to camera. You don't know how to do your job that well. And there's an entire town of like adult people with real jobs depending on you to give the information accurately and clearly. And you're like, but I'm 22. I'm hungover.
Yeah, you're figuring out how to basically be be Walter Cronkite or who's the guy that announced Kennedy's death, whatever his name is.
Was it Walter Cronkite?
No, that Walter Cronkite, I think, was he an anchor or was he a weatherman?
He was an anchor, yeah.
Okay, but I don't know if it was Walter Cronkite. I don't know. When I hear Cronkite, I think of snowstorms. I don't know why I associate Cronkite just sounds like the name of a particular type of storm cloud, but we got a Cronkite coming over the over the low. Anyway, but so yeah, trial by fire. That's insane. Like at least with my radio career, there was like I was hired as a low level board operator. Now, granted, I'm running live satellite radio shows. You know, so there is very little to no room for error, but it's still right. so much low cost stakes than. Set up a camera, talk to it, and make sure you hit record before you walked away from it and before you stood in
front of
it. Then you're also doing that whole thing like, am I in? Like, we're still, even in this day and age, we're still dealing with flipping a screen around, whether it's an iPhone or a camcorder or whatever, and just like, am I in frame? Looking at the tiny screen. It's like, am I in frame? Is this? And that, I'm sure there's so many three-quarter inch tape reels. That just has people going, all right, am I in frame? Okay. Before they start.
Yeah. I mean, luckily we're both from a generation that's pretty tech savvy. Like, you know, we grew up with the internet. It's crazy because I still keep up with like my university and see all the things that they do. I mean, now they're teaching these students how to report live from like the Arizona-Mexico border and report on like huge issues. They're not covering, you know, the state fair. They're covering things that are going to be in the next election, which is great. Students should be learning at because that is what they're going to be doing in the field, you know? But there is something to be said about the fact that your brain's not fully developed when you're 22. You are still a child and you have a huge responsibility to be a good journalist.
So when you moved back over to the East Coast, was you still as a report? Like, did you have to make a tape? Is there a portfolio for journalists? Like me in radio, it's an audition tape. I just record myself doing breaks and then I send it in. What's the portfolio look like for a news journalist?
It changes from job to job, right? Because when you're getting your first job out of college, it's going to be a lot of like kind of hokey news and like things you didn't maybe at your internship that some videographer was nice enough to shoot for you.
one of your classmates,
then, you know. Yeah, right. And that was definitely the case. I interned at CNN and there was this photographer that was nice enough to take me around Hollywood and have me like shoot a reporter stand up in front of the Hollywood sign, like that kind of thing. And that's why internships are so important. But jumping from one market to the next market, they need to be able to see that you're capable of taking on any story in real time and also be like likable and be able to talk to camera, which was huge for me later on being able to do stand up because I don't think I had the jitters a lot of people do.
Oh yeah. I mean, growing up as a theater kid, radio performer, doing all the stuff I did with music and bands and stuff that like when I finally at 31 stepped, decided to take stand up seriously, like I was doing open mics like once or twice a year here or there, but starting like at 29, I'll say 29. I have a hard time figuring out how long it is since I started stand up, but like I was working in radio. We had a, you know, channel 104.3. You know, they flipped from smooth jazz to alternative rock. I bugged one of the people who was the interim manager going, I live 10 minutes from the station in Baltimore. It's my format of music. Let me go help. And I was working there. And I was basically one of three employees running this whole thing. But I was had no control in anything going on, barely on air, decided to take my entertainment career in my hand and pursue stand up seriously now. And it was because of not having that thing ready, but going on stage and talking to people was easy for me because I've already been doing this my whole life. So like, I already didn't have that stage fright, which annoyed other comedians. And they're like, oh, you're new and you are comfortable on stage. Fuck you. You already know how to make the mic stand behind you when you talk. We don't like you.
That's huge. I mean, like, that's why I don't regret working in news at all. And you probably don't either. It's just, it teaches you skills that are so valuable. And even things like editing your own video. Well, I edit my own stand-up clips, you know, that's the game these days. So I don't regret those 4 years of my life. They were interesting. They were fun. They put me in situations I wouldn't have been in. And they gave me the skills that allow me to do what I do now.
So what was the impetus to start stand-up comedy? Because like I said, with me, it was because I wasn't being challenged creatively in radio. Because that was my idea, was go out, become a famous radio DJ, and then start doing stand up because that learning curve will be that curve of getting started will be easier if you can nail down this job, then the stand up comedian job comes more easily. Totally wrong. That was so negative of me to think. But, you know, I'm kicking myself. I didn't start doing stand up 10 years earlier. You know, 15 years earlier when I wanted, whatever it was. What was it that made you go, I need to start doing stand-up? You said you were a Jon Stewart fan. Was that like, if I want to get into that realm, I need to start learning stand-up? Was it something that happened that made you go, that's all right, that's it, I have to make this change, I have to start doing this now?
Yeah, I mean, I do sometimes feel the way you feel, like, God, I wish somebody had exposed me to comedy 10 years earlier so I could figure out joke structure earlier, you know, like get those basic foundations out of the way earlier so that you can learn to find your voice and all that through your 20s. But in a way, I do think it was lucky for me that I didn't find stand-up until I was 25. Because I was more of a person, you know. I had life experience. I'd moved around. I'd had real relationships. My life wasn't just bars and comedy clubs. But I didn't know what the path was. I didn't know anybody who was doing what I wanted to do. My parents weren't in that world at all. So I had started out doing improv just because that's the first thing I found. And that I'm really glad I did. It was really fun. I got to meet some of my favorite people in comedy and work up those improv chops. But then I knew that I wanted to be more on the writing side and working more alone. So I started doing stand-up and sketch at the same time.
Was this with Big, Baltimore Improv Group?
I was both with Big, and I was at what I think it's still called Zissimo's, but then they like called it the Lou Room Live for a while.
Yeah, that's a whole mess in itself.
Like
the whole transition between Megan and Michael, and now it's closing or he's leaving. I haven't figured out what the thing behind what's going on now, but I know he's no longer going to be involved with it. I don't know if they're stopping comedy or what, if he's walking away, but okay. So yeah, because Big was around, you know, Baltimore Improv Group. Improv is the gateway drug to stand-up comedy for so many people.
Yeah.
Like there's something about how, like, it's because they advertise. That's why. We can find out how, how to do these things. Like, if you start Googling stand-up comedy, improv comes up. They're like, hey, did you mean improv? Hey, do you want to come to improv school? Because that's how they make their money, is, you know, that incestuous, you know, business plan of make your audience your students, make your students the audience, and cannibalize the whole thing in a cyclical cycle. No offense, not to chain on any company in general itself. I know, have a lot of friends.
Yeah, but it's a business. Yeah,
there is a very cannibalistic business model to most of the improv world. Whereas comedy clubs, they're like, we just want to sell chicken fingers and beers. Get in here and say your funnies and get out of the way so we can sell our beers
right.
and chicken fingers and chicken wings and stuff. So
right. And improv, I think, can be kind of for anybody. Not that anybody can't try stand up, but like improv can be for somebody that just wants better relationships at work or wants to be more confident in their own skin or whatever. There's so many like useful ways to use improv. I think stand up, hopefully you're doing it because it's something that you want to do for the rest of your life. Otherwise, it can be a pretty dreary existence.
Oh, there's a lot of 20-year-olds that start doing comedy and improv because they're like, I'm out of school. I don't have friends. How do I make friends? And then that becomes their social circle for the rest of their lives. And they never care about actually being good at it. I'm looking at you, Asylum and Improv Boston. But talking specifically to the mediocre schools here in Boston.
It's a pandemic. There's so many people now that just want to be looked at and want to be seen that get into stand up so that they can just be looked at, you know, like, look at me, I'm on stage. Like, look at me. Here's a reason for me to post content. And it's like, but do you actually care about stand up? Do you watch stand up and enjoy it? Like, do you enjoy writing? Like, if you don't enjoy writing, don't do it, you know, because that is the job. The job is writing. Being on stage is part two, you know?
All right. So I don't want to call them stock questions, but they're questions I ask often because I feel like they're very integral. The answers are very integral to our industry of comedy. I'm going to ask both of them to you. And I've had to preface this statement before to people that it's not a question I want to ask because I want to bring you on and just talk to you as a comedian and not have to ask you, well, as a woman in comedy, but this question is only specific to women in comedy. I think you've already touched on what the answer is going to be. It is that I've found out while talking to various women in comedy, they didn't have any female comedy icons growing up. I've talked to women that are like, I never saw a woman do stand up until I did stand up. But for me, who was a comedy, you know, I born in 81, I grew up watching stand-up comedy on TV every day. And I saw women doing comedy. Lucille Ball, Hilda Radner, you know, Jane Curtin, and you know, Saturday Night Live, and Joan Rivers, and many, you know, women doing comedy. And because I was a deep comedy nerd. But for some people who had a more superficial lifestyle with comedy, they didn't have that deep female comedy background. You know, I remember being in elementary school and arguing that, look, women are funny. Have you not seen Joan Rivers like getting in the fistfights on the school ground, like defending?
Right.
Like, I wanted to grow up to be Lucille Ball. Like, that's like, that was me as a kid. Was like, I want to do what she does. But for you growing up, did you have any female comedy icons growing up?
Well, I think I did have female comedy actress icons, like all the ones you just named. And also, what's the name of that actress who was in Young Frankenstein who's so freaking funny?
Not Gar. That's the rolling the hay. Terry Gar.
Yeah. What is her name?
Like, Terry Gar.
That's one of my favorite movies growing up. And like, I just remember watching her and wanting to be like her. And Joan Rivers and Lucille Ball. Like, I wanted to embody that. Like, you know, like take up space in a room and be goofy, you know? But as far as stand-up goes, yeah. I mean, I would say my early influences were mostly men. Just because I wasn't as exposed to the larger comedy world. And I feel like the media wasn't really pushing women to the forefront in stand up as much. Luckily that's changed.
I recently discovered Judy Gold when I'm like, I saw her half hour special when I was 12. How do you not know who Judy Gold is? You know?
Yeah. Unfortunately, I think the only female stand up special I saw as a child was Ellen DeGeneres, which is not like the blueprint.
I mean, arguably, one of the biggest female comedians of the past three decades.
Yeah. So, but I don't know. Now I have so many female icons that influence me every day. But I would say, yeah, early on it was mostly men.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I still have a hard time wrapping my head around that. When I talked talk to other. I mean, some of them like, oh yeah, no, I knew, you know, so and so growing up, this and that. But it's still like, it's unfathomable for me to grow up and not think of female comedy icons, and even living up, I can't imagine not having male comedy icons, like just to cross gender roles, obviously, like the look. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine not having someone to identify with growing up, because mm-hmm. even, I mean, growing up in Baltimore, such a city of diversity, which I didn't realize how diverse Baltimore was until I moved to Boston, where it's devoid of diversity.
Right. I think we're so privileged that way, because
yeah, even being outside of DC, DC's a microcosm of all kinds of ethnicities.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up specifically in Aspen Hill, which is mostly Black and Latino, and mm-hmm. I thought the rest of the world was that way. Like I'm not trying to be naive, but I don't think, not that people that I lived with didn't experience racism, but race wasn't like as much of a thing there, because we were all in it together, you know, like we were all poor and we were all in this neighborhood and we didn't think about race as much, or at least, I don't know, maybe not as much as in other parts of the country, which actually I would say a lot of my early comedy icons were probably Black, because my friends would show me Black comedians. And then, you know, as I started to learn more about comedy, I would learn more about, you know, some of the other greats and stuff. And I started to see this larger world that included all kinds of races and all genders and everything. But as far as women go, I feel like a lot of early female stand-ups kind of had to be a little bro-y, and we're finally entering this era where women can be women on stage. Like, they can be feminine and talk about female issues and not have to feel like they have to appeal to male humor, you know?
Yeah, that is a thing that you have to think of it too. Like, when you look back at old, I can't remember her name, Phyllis Diller stuff, looking at, I have to talk about, they had to make jokes about their husbands just to get the men in the audience involved in the conversation of laughter. Mm-hmm. You know, now you can actually talk about real women's issues, and like, God bless, you know, Beth Stelling, who brought up who opened the whole door of sexual assault and relationships.
I love Beth.
Open that, you know, and Beth is one of the nicest people I've in comedy I've ever met. And it's, you know, it's almost hard to understand. How could anyone abuse her? She's so sweet. But anyway, The other question that is kind of a stock question, and I love this question, and I'm going to preface this with, there are no wrong answers, because sometimes people hear this question, they're like, oh, I don't want to pick one or the other. I want to say both because it makes me look like a better performer. There is no both. It is one or the other. Neither is wrong. Early in comedy, me and a comedian were at an open mic talking about stuff afterwards, and he had mentioned that he feels more like a writer. And I was like, not at all. My comedy is not writing. My comedy is performance. It's the reason I write jokes is so I have a reason to go on that stage. He goes, oh, that's interesting, because I go on stage because I write things and I have to say them. Right? I was like, the writing process is just a necessary evil for me to perform comedy, which, by the way, I love writing. I'm not one of those guys like, I write a 10 and then I just keep doing it the rest of my life. No, I love writing new material, but it's the performing of that material why I write it. So do you consider yourself more to be a writer or a performer, in that you write because you have the need to perform, making you more a performer, or do you perform because you have the need to write?
I would say early on, when I first started comedy, because I did improv and sketch, I was a much more physical comedian, which I am trying to get back to. I did a lot more act outs, I did a lot more characters, and I don't really do that as much anymore, because I had this realization that in order to develop a point of view, I needed to write down my thoughts so I could go back and analyze them and be like, oh, this is true, and this is also true, and this all kind of falls under the same brand, which is who I am intrinsically and how I see the world, and all of these jokes fit together, and this is why it's funny, right? Here's this friction between these two ideas, and that's where the humor is. So I needed to be able to physically map out like what the funny was. And I did that through writing. And now, because I really focus on structure and trying to paint a larger, more complete picture in terms of like a full 10-minute set, as opposed to just piecemeal jokes, I definitely focus on the writing a lot more, but I am trying to get back to that original version of myself on stage that was a lot more physical. So I think you have to be a good writer. If you're just like fucking around on stage, like, duh, you know, fart jokes.
Like, again, it's not about which is better or which is worse. Like, it's
right.
Like performing, you still have the right to perform. But right. It's like, I feel like I'm me, my most when I'm on stage. Some people are their most when they're writing. Like, I guess that's where I'm trying to get to is like, where's your brain working? Is your brain creating things to write that you just have, I have to perform these things that I've written? Or are you, I want to perform, so let me go write something so I can go out and perform. And I think I'm more the latter. And I just clips online talking to you. I think you're more the latter as well. Doesn't mean you don't write. Doesn't mean that you can't write. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean that your writing's subpar or more brilliant. It means that I think you have the in you to go out and perform. Or it's Kevin Pollak will call it. He calls it the hey, hey, look at me gene. Or hey, hey, look at me disease. I think we both have that where it's like, we want to be out there. We want to be formed. We want to be in the people. Like, we want to be out there, and we have to have the material to go out there with. And I think you are more in that category. But
that's interesting. It's interesting to hear that from somebody else looking in. I feel like I don't find the funny until I do it in front of people and I can literally read their reactions. That's the joy for me, is like seeing like, okay, I'm going to throw this out there and I'm watching your face. And now I'm going to take it this direction that I hadn't thought of when I was sitting down, writing it down. So definitely that's true. And that's where I find the most joy. But I like kind of hate being looked at. Like, I'm an intro, like I hate, like in social circles, I don't like to be like observed. I'm an introvert. I don't want to be the center of attention. I only like being the center of attention when I'm on stage.
I mean, I've talked to a lot of people that like, they're like, I could never imagine getting on stage, but doing comedy makes me able to actually talk to people in person now. So there is that, that this industry has helped people who have anxiety and social awkwardness problems, which I admitted to 39 minutes ago, meeting you for the first time when we opened this conversation. So maybe I don't know you as well as I say. But I think you seem more outgoing than I think you like to give yourself credit for. Like, even as a journalist, when you go out and interview people, you have to have some semblance of being able to go, all right, let me talk to this person.
Yeah, no, I think I know how to like turn it on in terms of like being social and, you know, trying to make myself likable. But in terms of like how I feel when I walk into a room at a party, like, I don't want to be stared at. I don't want to drag attention to myself. Like, once I start talking to people, I'll get into that mode, you know, like hostess mode. But like, there are people that just like to be loud and just like to be the goofball. And like that's never really been me. I like to, there is almost like a one-on-one interaction, even when you're in front of a crowd. Like, it feels kind of like I'm talking to one person a little bit.
Yeah, as somebody who's, you know, self-aware and has been performing for a while, you know, both outside of comedy and doing things with groups of people. I sit in the back room watching other comedians and some days just laugh to myself and was like, he's not looking them in the eye. He's still looking the audience right over the top of their heads. And that's, to me, as someone who has to desperately look people in the eye as I'm doing comedy, I find it so funny that people I've known for years who still do the trick of, I'm just going to stare right above your heads and not actually look at any of you because it makes me uncomfortable.
But I've even seen pros do that. I mean, I think Mark Norman, who's one of my favorite comedians, and I've gotten to meet him a few times over the years. He's very like likable on a one-on-one basis, but when he is performing, I notice that he does tend to look kind of like into the ether, you know? Probably changes when he's doing crowd work a little bit, but I don't know. There's some people that just operate that way.
Well, it's hard to pick out the race of a person if you're not looking at that person person in the face. So, I mean, especially with Mark Norman, how does he not point out people's races every single time? Like, I've seen him just look at people and go, so you're Indian. And that's what he just starts. That's what he opens with. So, all right. Baltimore, working in news, started doing comedy. Was there always a concern that the work will find out about the comedy, because it's never been a problem for me, but it's been a problem for a lot of people. They're like, oh, I can't let my work find out the things I say on stage, or I think it's a silly concern, but.
Oh yeah, 1,000%. That's why, you know, I started, Kelly's my legal name, but I kind of started using my childhood nickname when I was in college. And then,
by the way, when I want to point out, my notes, first question was, is Kiki your real name? Because I've never met a real born Kiki. I've met a lot of Kikis, and none of them were born Kikis.
No, there's a lot of Kieras, Kiaras, Kianas, but Kiki, for some reason, was my childhood nickname. I think the story my family has all decided to agree on is that I was obsessed with Mickey Mouse, and so I would say I'm Kiki Mouse. So my nickname was Kiki Mouse, and then it was just Kiki. And then in college, I was like, I don't want to be Kelly. I don't like that name. I want to be different. And so then I started using that name when I was on stage, because I could hide that I was doing comedy better that way. And I felt like it was more personal. But I always say to people, I'm like, yeah, you can't report on the mayor and talk shit about the mayor. Like, that's a quick way to get fired.
Well, what was the last straw to leaving the news media industry?
My contract was ending and I hated where I worked. News is a terrible industry, and it was just the kick out the door that I needed to pursue my real dream. And also I'm still a news junkie. I read the news every day. I listen to the news every day, but I'm so glad I'm not in it anymore.
See, I'm the opposite. When iHeartRadio decided they didn't need me in the news industry anymore, which is what brought me to Boston, I stopped paying attention to news so hard. Like, I barely know what's going on anywhere. And it's same thing with music. Like, when I switched from listening to music every day to listening to podcasts on my commutes, I've lost track of new bands and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably less of a news junkie than I was when I was in news. I used to know everything that was going on. Now I know the basics. You know, I listen to the 5-minute CNN five things. You know, I microdose the news, and I think that's healthy.
That's a nice way to put in the microdosing of the news. Like, nice. But so, yeah. What was the plan then? Like, which contract came to end? Was it BFF, or had you already left Baltimore for another news? Where are we at?
No, my contract ended at BFF.
WBFF,
we're now in
a news station in Baltimore. Sorry. You left your best friend forever? No. Which, by the way,
how did they have great call letters?
Not in their marketing. It's like, WBFF News, we're your best friend forever news. Right? Hire me, Fox 45.
I think they've got a lot of enemies, so a lot of people would take issue with that. I am one of their enemies. I don't know if I'm legally allowed to say that.
Don't worry. When iHeartRadio got rid of me, police were involved. So trust me, I know what it's like.
Holy shit.
Yeah. Well, they just thought I was going to come shoot up the building. I don't know why, but probably because of this haircut, but.
Well, you did steal some of their stuff, so they did have some reason to worry.
Oh, that's not why they sent the police. They just thought I was a crazy gunman who was going to come back with a gun. I was like, I don't even own one. No, I'm too sad and depressed to come shoot up the building.
I feel like there's more to the story than you're telling us.
Yeah, I'm trying to not do my bit. That it's a whole bit on stage. I'm trying to just do the parts that's not part of the bit.
Got it. Save it for the stage. Keep yourself out of trouble.
So the contract's ending with WBFF. What was the plan? Because I'm a consummate planner. Like, I did not move out of Baltimore because I couldn't get jobs in other places. Right? I the people who I know that's like, oh, I'm just going to move there and find a job when I get there. I'm like, that's insane. What is wrong with you? Why would you ever do such a thing? What was the plan?
I didn't have a hard plan. I think the dream was to move to New York, actually. But things happened in my family that ended up putting us all out here in LA, which was fine because I already had family in LA. So, you know, I moved to LA a year before the pandemic hit, and thank God I had family here, because that would have been miserable. I didn't really have a lot of friends. I didn't have like a network. So at least we were in a beautiful, sunny place and all of us were together, you know?
Oh, and I mean, let's talk about the pandemic. I never thought I would still be talking about the pandemic this this long, but it really did affect a lot of our lives, especially when it comes to jobs. For me, I was doing AV tech at a hotel when the pandemic hit, and then got furloughed, and then got laid off, and then got fired, and now the pandemic's, I got to find income for the pandemic. And a lot of people, it really affected our lives. Like some people, God bless the people that got to work during the pandemic from home, and they didn't have financial problems, and they got all those checks and extra money, you were able to squirrel it away. Meanwhile, me still trying to figure out how to pay my life with going from a freelancer to nothing. Not all of us came out the pandemic as better off than when we were
unscathed.
Yeah.
No,
I love the pandemic. I love doing Zoom shows, doing Clubhouse and stuff like that. But for you, what was your pandemic like? You're in a new city with at least family. I'm 400 miles from my family. Didn't get to see my family. The only people I saw was my roommate and now the dog that I have. And the only reason I say the only reason I got the dog during the pandemic is because I had somebody else to talk to other than my roommate. And that sentence also gets you kicked out of PetSmart.
Well, I'm sorry you went through that. You should probably see a therapist. I think all of us need more therapy than we think after the pandemic, for sure. We have trauma we don't even know about.
Yeah.
But I definitely have not fully bounced back from the pandemic. Like, I was working as an assistant in a writer's room. Like, I was on a steady path career-wise. And I haven't really had a stable job since then. I've been in and out of jobs. But as far as stand-up goes, like, that was a growth period for me. I did a lot of writing. And, you know, once people started kind of going out a little more and doing outdoor shows, my friend and I created a show, and that connected me with a lot of people in the community that helped launch me to the next level. But it did rob me of 2 years. Like, it robbed so many people. I feel like I tell people I've been doing stand-up 6 years, but really it's been 4, you know? So I feel like we all got held back a few grades.
So let's talk about being a writer assistant in a writing room, because for me, that's a dream. Sitting around a room with people and just pitching ideas and storylines. Ah, I love the idea. But it's probably because I romanticize it because I listened to the Nerdist Writers Panel podcast. And it sounds like a dream job when it probably is nerve-wracking. How did you get the job as a writing assistant? And what are you allowed to say what show you were writing assistant on?
I'm going to not say it just because I didn't really have a positive experience. It was hell.
All right, let's not talk about the show, but please dish that dirt.
Yeah, I think that it was a mix of things that clashed. I had just moved from Baltimore, and I had a bit of an ego in the sense that, like, I had a real career. I had won awards in my field. I was an adult. As much as news has its own issues, I was an adult in the writer's room, and I was treated like an adult, you know? And I was good at my job, and people respected me for it. I came to this writer's room where I am an adult, but people are treating you like a child and talking down to you and bullying you and just treating you like the scum of the earth. And I was, like, not willing or ready to receive that kind of treatment. I think that is maybe a job for somebody who's 21 and doesn't know better. But when you're 27 or however old I was at the time, like, I was not down. I was not down to be, like, verbally berated in front of my peers. I was not okay with writers, like, blowing up the kitchen and making a huge mess on purpose and not cleaning up after themselves, or, like, screaming at me because I didn't find the right ice cream flavor. Like, I just came from Baltimore where I was covering murders, like real problems with real people. And for me, I couldn't get behind somebody whose day was ruined because I didn't find them the right ice cream bars. So I think it was probably a clash of personalities, but I have to believe, I hope that not every writer's room is like that, and that there are more sane people that don't treat their assistants like shit, you know, like, just because somebody's an assistant doesn't give you the right to treat them that way.
I got
to
imagine the I can empathize with the frustration of, hey, I'm a real professional person in this relative field. I should also be treated as a real experienced professional in this adjacent field. And then to not get that, like, I honestly, that's one thing that listening to all these stories of writers' rooms and stuff where people started out, in my own brain, sometimes I feel that where it's like, hey, I've been writing things for decades now, right? I've worked in TV. I've worked in radio. I've worked in major motion pictures. I have experience in these fields. And then to have to start in the bottom as a writing assistant, which is always a great place to start out if you want to learn to be a writer for entertainment. But at the same time...
But you know, Dennis, even if I hadn't had any experience, even if I was a janitor, like, I don't think it's right to treat people that way.
No,
I think
correct.
It is so, these people live in a bubble where they think they can get away with, like, dehumanizing somebody just because they're in a lower position. And I'm like, I have a family. I have people that love me. Like, like, I'm a person. You can't bully me this way. Like, why are you acting this way? I mean, I remember one time, my boss lost her shit because, like, her smoothie, she had asked me for a matcha mint smoothie with no matcha and no mint. And I'm like, so you want a cup of milk? And then she was mad because she didn't like the way it tasted. And so she screamed at me and wanted me to go scream at the person that made it. And I'm like, you're crazy. You're the crazy person here. This is not a normal way to act. But then another time, like, she asked me to hang up picture frames in her office, and then she didn't like the way the picture frames were hung. And she, like verbally at the top of her lungs, like, berated me and the other assistant and made the other girl cry. And I'm like, well, and you want to know why I have a bad attitude about working here? This isn't a normal way to treat people, you know?
Yeah, I mean, on top of, like, starting at the bottom rung, on top of it just being abused, it's a terrible, terrible way to have a job, so... Understandably, why you would not want to be back in that, why that creates a toxic work environment, you know. And then sometimes, yeah, it's horrible sounding, the experience that you had with the rent. And I can't wait to find out what show this was.
And there are people that have way worse. I mean, I've talked to other assistants who have had it way worse. I think I probably had the Diet Coke version of abuse. But it was jarring for me coming from a place where, like, you know, I, on a regular basis, had to have conversations with mothers whose sons were shot in the streets, you know? And I'm like, and you're losing your shit over an ice cream sandwich? What's wrong with you? Like,
yeah. And honestly, hats off to all of the journalists in Baltimore. You, BFF, WJZ, WLIF, that's a soft rock station. But, I mean, Baltimore, I mean, you're doing real journalism in Baltimore. You can't not. I mean... God bless Justin Fenton, and I don't know if he's fallen from grace or what else is going on, but that man put foot to pavement every day in the city of Baltimore to cover every single murder that happened, you know, and now he's left the Baltimore Sun, and he's on his own, and I don't know what's happened since that, but, like, bless this dude's heart and every journalist that had to deal with real, actual news. I occasionally look at the local news here in Boston, and I'm like, this is such fluff, it's ridiculous. And then you have some real story actually happen, and they barely give it coverage. And you're like, go out and do some goddamn journalism.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for me, like, most of my news experience in the newsroom was as a traffic reporter. That's what brought me up here to Boston, was to write traffic reports for the reporters. And I remember when I was in D.C., every hour we would have to call the police barracks. We had a list of police barracks. We'd have to call and compare our notes to theirs every hour. And they were happy that we called. Because they know that we're doing real work and that we're trying to keep the streets safe. When there's a traffic accident, we have to tell people about so they can avoid it and have less incidents of accidents happening in an area. Like, it makes the cops' lives safer. I get the boss in here. I literally would call a police barrack, like, hey, calling about a crash on Route 101 in just outside of Manchester. We just want to know which lane is blocked, right lane or left lane. He goes, there's no crash on 101. Like, okay, yep. I mean, there is a crash. We know it's there. We just want to know what lane is. No, there's never been a crash there ever in the history of everything. And I'm like, what are you doing? Why are you fighting us? For, like, and the other journal and the other people that were producers and reporters up here told me that, like, oh, we don't call police. I'm like, why? We listen to the police scanners, and then they'll know we're listening to the scanners because they'll hear our report, and then they'll change channels so they can purposely keep us from listening to them about things. And it's like, it's a traffic incident. It's not like we're, like, we had to fight with them during the Boston bombing to get police scanner access just so we could talk about the traffic events that were going on during that week while they're looking for those two guys. Like, it's so insane how easily they just give up doing any journalism up here in general when it compares to
Baltimore.
What I'm used to reading and hearing every day in Baltimore.
That's so funny because I remember the police spokesperson in Eugene. She was her own brand of crazy. And I remember her saying in a press conference, she was like, it's not, she was saying this to the reporter. She's like, it is not your job to ask us questions. It is your job to report what we tell you. And I'm like, what? In what universe do you live? Even in the movies, the reporters are asking questions.
It's not your job to ask questions. Like, yeah, no, literally, that's what we were taught.
Yeah, what? There's so many jokes I could crack about policing, but I'll keep myself out of trouble for today.
Yeah, I mean, in life, when it comes to getting, when it comes to police, it's getting worse. Like, honestly, I said, when it comes to, I said something, my new job now is I've left the entire entertainment industry, and my job is I'm a Boston Duck Tour narrator. So I drive around Boston, the city I hate, and tell people about the wonderful history of Boston. And I literally...
Oh, you hate Boston?
Oh, I despise it. Ugh, I hate it. But I can't wait to get out of here. But that's a whole nother podcast conversation. But the thing about, every time... Like, I had I'm in the middle of a narration, stopped at a red light. Cop car walks up and goes, hey, did you fix all the holes in these things yet? And I look down, I'm on microphone in the busiest intersection of Boston. You went, no, the only thing that puts holes in things is you, officer. Anyway, moving on. And I literally had to worry that someone was going to complain about that. I would lose my job for making fun of a cop who, in fairness, opened the lines of harassment with me. It was like, hey, did you fix the holes in your boats that sink? Like, no, we've never sank. You're an asshole. Leave me alone, officer.
Yeah, he was kind of ragging on you. He was asking for it.
Yeah, and that's the, you know, we're in that world now where we're at odds with, yeah, I remember growing up, you know, police, I don't know, maybe it's copaganda. Maybe I grew up with copaganda where it's like, police literally were to protect and serve. Now it's like, it's to rule and enforce. And it's like, no, that's not, it's getting worse and worse when it comes to police brutality. Like, even in Baltimore, like, when those whole riots and everything happened, it was really hard to talk about Freddie Gray being an incident of, and maybe you have a different opinion because you are a person of color and I'm devoid of it. But the Freddie Gray incident, like, I had to tell people, like, this was not a race incident. It was a poverty incident. Baltimore has a class issue more than it has a race issue, because it's hard to say that the police are racist when 64% of the police force is people of color. There's a police enforcing issue, but that goes outside of color lines, and the city's ran by people of color. So it's hard to say that there's a color problem when it comes to the people of Baltimore, when the people, it's more a class issue. Like, you have people of this economic status and people of a different economic status, and they're classing.
That is an interesting way to put it. I mean, because after Freddie Gray came the Gun Trace Task Force, which was the police gang.
Yeah.
And I mean, yeah, half of them were people of color now.
Yeah, and if you don't know about the police task force gang, you can watch the very depressing and not well done TV show on HBO called We Run the City.
Oh, I haven't watched it. Is it not good?
Yeah. I had no problems with it. I liked it. I think it could have been edited better. John Bernthal's performance is great. His Baltimore accent's terrible. It's a Philly accent.
You know
accent.
What is a great... Kate Winslet did... I know it was supposed to be like Philly, but it was very close to a Baltimore accent in Mare of Easttown. Kate Winslet nailed it.
See, I don't know about her. I know she did... Everyone told me she does a great Philly accent in it. And I have not watched the show, but... John Bernthal does. It looked like John Bernthal watched that Kate Winslet show and then tried to mimic her accent. That's what it sounded like to me. But
so the game of telephone for accents. Yeah.
And then the best accent was Josh Charles, who is from Baltimore. He does, like, it's almost a cartoonish Baltimore accent. But here's the thing: if you listen to recordings of the guy he's impersonating, they're fucking dead on. Like, the guy he's impersonating has this super thick, cartoonish Baltimore accent horn, and it's just like, oh no, he nailed it. It sounds like he's overdoing it, but no, he nailed this guy's voice.
That is so funny. God, I wish I was better at accents, because I would love to do Baltimore accents, but it just doesn't come out for me.
Oh, trust me, it's not worth trying to, it's not worth listening to. coming from a guy who has a father with the accent, and my mother falls into it every once in a while too. And if I get drunk enough when I'm hanging out at the Blarney Stone at 704 South Broadway Street in Fells Point, you'll hear a little bit of my Baltimore accent come out to you, hon. But
just the way you said stone there, definitely. Yeah, have you seen Fred Armisen's special? I think it's called like Stand Up for Drummers.
Yes, and I love it.
He does the thing with the map and he points to Baltimore and he's like, whenever I think of Baltimore, I think of motor oil.
going up Blair Road there to the Home Depot so we can pick up a zinc to wash our clothes with water.
That was pretty good.
I mean, that's a sentence I've actually had to say in my real life, but
yep.
So what moving to LA, getting in there, what was the job hunt like?
I can't remember what my first job was.
Don't worry, there's not going to be fact checking.
Yeah, no, I just have to think back a little bit. I don't remember what I did when I first moved here, but in terms of like, I did get that job in the writer's room, which was, I mean, that was by the grace of my aunt, who's an angel. I mean, she had like very briefly met this person at a party years ago. And so she called a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend to find out who that person was. And that person lives in England and he called his friend all the way out here. So it was just like, you know, just living on a prayer, like hoping to God somebody would not only connect us, but be nice enough to help. And he was nice enough to help. And unfortunately, I ended up in a very toxic writer's room anyway.
And did the pandemic kill that job or were you able to escape?
The pandemic did kill that job because they did move to a virtual writer's room. So they didn't need an assistant anymore. Hmm. And I just haven't found that kind of entryway in. It's so hard to come across those jobs. But I think I'm just too old to be an assistant, Dennis. I'm too old to get people coffee.
As an assistant to something that I'm already semi-familiar with. I agree with you.
And it's not that I'm above it, because I'm not above like printing things and making coffee, but I think I just don't have the tolerance to be bullied. Like, yeah. I'm not 21 anymore, you know?
I mean, going back to mentioning Mark Norman, there's so many times where I hear him listen to his podcast where he talks about fucking up his flight, fucking up his hotel, not being able to get his Uber ride schedule and stuff. It's like, and they're like, you need an assistant. I'm like, oh, man, I'm so good at planning and organizing. I should be his assistant. And then just ask him to open for me. And then I was like, I'm not going to be a 42-year-old assistant. No, that's not that's not where I'm going to start at.
Yeah, but I'd be an assistant for Mark Norman or like one of my comedy heroes, like, because I think the reward of like just learning from them would be so good that I would be willing to eat a little bit of shit and maybe deal with a temper here and there. But the reward wasn't that good, and I think that was also a big change, like a big deciding factor changing from news to comedy, is the rewards in news were so few and far between and the abuse was so often that I'm like, the rewards don't even taste good anymore. For me, yeah, comedy is a fucking grind and it has its own problems that are really severe and very apparent. But the rewards, the big laughs and then having a new joke work and being able to like maybe open for somebody that I really admire, that reward still tastes so good. You know, it still hits. That high still hit, so I'm willing to eat shit for the foreseeable future.
All right, well, we're in freelance mode then, apparently, is what I'm gathering from you now that we're post-pandemic, things are reopening. Like, you don't have to talk about your finances, but I'm sure we're at the level where comedy's not paying all of our bills. There's if comedy could pay a cell phone bill a month, that's a success in our industry. So
for sure.
Where are we freelance, like, I know you're out there trying to do, you know, copywriting. Like, I'm going to imagine you're out there trying to get copywriting jobs or are you writing? Are you doing freelance article writing? Where are we at currently with the career? Is the background in news helping out with that?
Yes and no. The thing is, like, the transferable skills that I have from news are a dime a dozen out here. Everybody can do social media. Everybody can copyright. Everybody can edit video. Everyone's here is good at everything. So there's a lot of competition. So honestly, the job I worked last week, I was loading and unloading a truck for a Gatorade event. The mighty have fallen.
You know what? Who needs a gym membership when you can unload trucks? All right. Like, look, when I was unloading trucks, when I was an inmate at the Baltimore County Detention Center, I was the thinnest I ever was, just unloading trucks into the kitchen.
Yeah. And you know what? I found out that I kind of like manual labor. It makes you feel tough. And it feels like you really did a day's work. I really earned my money. So
now at 42, I left doing AV tech at a hotel because I got tired of crawling around the floors taping down mic cables. I'm like, I'm going to tape down my last one day. I'm going to get on my knees and tape down a mic cable, and then I'm never going to be able to get back up. So that's why
that's real.
I took a job going Boston, Paul Revere. Yay! Because I got tired of doing manual labor at my age and, you know, not taking care of my body for all these years. So that's where, you know, I'm at, like, nope, don't want to do that manual labor stuff. But, like, you telling me unloading a truck sounds like absolute torture to me.
I will tell you, I figured out I'm 31. I'm about to turn 32. The age where you start making involuntary noises apparently is 31 and a half, because all of a sudden I'm like, this is really unattractive.
All right. So how is current post-pandemic LA comedy now?
I think it's better than ever.
You think so?
Yeah, I think there's a hunger for it.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've seen people use social media in a variety of ways. And social media is the bane of everybody's existence. We all complain and bitch about it. We hate having to put up clips. We hate crowd work. We hate this. We hate that. But the market's growing, you know? The comedy fans are growing. The amount of shows, like, independently run are growing. And that's all great for everybody, I think.
That's good, because they had a hard time reopening. From my experience, just watching on, like, how much, like, we started, you know, the club I worked for that I did sound for here in Boston, Laugh Boston, they opened their doors April 1st, 2021. We started doing shows in 2021 indoors, you know, and then Massachusetts was notoriously high mask and very safe. And here's all the rules and stuff, and almost nearly as bad as California. But I remember throughout 2021, California, you know, like, I did a lot of work with Flappers and a lot of other, you know, comedians in LA in general. We went through a long time of watching them slowly reopen, and still, like, even when I was there last year in February of last year, so what was that, 2022? There were still mask-only venues when I was out there last year. So in 2023, you're saying things are still going strong and that there's a hunger for it in the audience. Like, you're not losing audiences. Like, here in Boston, we've lost shows, we've lost venues. Like,
yeah, that definitely happened. I mean, I think the immediate effects were definitely felt out here. I think we lost venues and we did lose shows, and yeah, it was felt here too, for sure. But I think in the long run, it's been good for comedy. And yeah, there's a lot of people doing comedy, and that fucking sucks. And most of them should quit.
Oh, the thing I say about the pandemic is it made a lot of people quit who shouldn't have quit, and made a lot of people who we wish quit not quit.
Right, right. The competition is more severe than ever before. But,
and of course,
whatever.
Like, the more established comedians out there talk about, you know, the mass exodus to Austin. Like, oh, LA's not the same. Everybody's in Austin now. Austin's going to be the new LA. And it's like, I've been to Austin in the past year. I've been to LA in the past year. And honestly, I'm picking LA over Austin, which is a stark contrast, because when I was in Austin doing comedy in 2016 for a day, I just went for one show, or I had three shows in a day that I was out there for. Nice. And I love the city. And then I just recently went back a couple weeks ago just for the day again. And it's like, what the fuck happened to the city? It's a goddamn nightmare now. Like, I'm walking back from my car after doing a show, and it's like just homeless people fucking fist fighting, screaming at each other in the streets. And Austin seems like a goddamn fucking cesspool now. And I was talking to people in Dallas where I was staying for the week, and they're like, yeah, no, it's gotten worse. It wasn't rose colored glasses. The city has gotten worse. So it sounds like the bad comedy element of LA moved to Austin.
I don't know if I'd say that. I mean, definitely.
Don't let me put words in your mouth.
There definitely, it does feel like the Wild West out there. Like, I was there for Halloween weekend, and it does feel, I mean, it has
Oh my
all the
God, we just
homelessness.
missed each other. I was there the week before
Really?
Halloween. Yeah. I literally was
Wow.
there. I think I left the, I was there the 20th to the 28th of October.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, because like Formula One had just been there, and then they were having some music festival and some film festival, and then it was Halloween weekend, so everybody was descending upon Austin. And it definitely, it has all the homelessness of LA mixed with like the rowdiness and trashiness of Vegas. So there's people like barfing in the streets and shooting guns and shit. I'm like, what the hell is happening here? But I don't know. I had fun. It's an interesting scene because everyone I talked to had like just moved there. Like it feels like the gold rush of California, but for comedy in Austin. Like everyone just arrived here and they just started comedy and they have bright eyes and bushy tails. I'm like, this is interesting.
That you come to LA with hope, you go to Austin with despair and guns. I did, by the way, I was hanging out at Creek in the Cave, and I decided to do their open mic and their midnight open mic, which was like, which is everything wrong with comedy open mic. Like, it was just like insane people rambling off their meds and just dude after dude after dude talking about, so this bitch should have been sucking my cock or whatever, misogynistic vomit would come out of their mouths. And I was sitting outside with other comedians, and I just had mentioned that I was like, yeah, I don't really like listening to Joe Rogan's podcast. And you would have thought that I would have mollywopped this guy in the face. He was so offended. This other comedian, and in his defense, he did just come to the Creek and Cave from performing at the Mothership Club that is owned by Joe Rogan. Like, we were just talking around. He's like, yeah, I just can't listen to his podcast anymore. It's just too much rambling and insane. He was like trembling, like, you don't look, Joe Rogan. I just think Joe Rogan is a good listener. I'm like, what?
There's definitely a cultural difference, like within one block away from each other. Creek in the Cave is a totally different club, totally different scene than Joe Rogan's club.
Yeah. And there's a crossover, unfortunately, and I was not supposed to be in that Venn diagram of the crossover. All right, so what currently, where are we at with comedy and working, and what's the hopeful plans for the future, Kiki? It's the end
Well,
of it's, I don't know when this I'm gonna have this episode out, but let's just tell everybody it's almost the end of 2023. I'm not a resolutions guy. I'm not the kind of guy that's like, oh, make a plan for the future. Vision boards and bullshit. But you know what? Fuck it. Let's do some resolutions. Let's do some vision board hopes for the 2024 year, Kiki. You've had you've had some rough times. I've had some rough times. I'm not gonna go into it, but what's on the road for 2024 in your hopes?
I've got
That
some
was a
road
question you weren't
dates.
expecting to be asked on a podcast. Give me your vision board.
Give me your vision board.
But I mean, like,
I
as you're
guess I should
working
start building
freelance, like,
one.
is there anything in plans when it comes to getting back to, you just said yourself that you've been, that since the pandemic, you haven't had stable footing in a job. Is there any plans or hopes of something on the leeway? For me, a year ago, I literally was, if I was asked this question, it would be, I hope I get this job with Boston Duck Tours so I can actually have a stable income and put money away. Like, that was my hope last year. Some of, most of it was true. Well, yeah, I got the job, got some money, put some money away, didn't put
There you
enough away.
go.
But, going into
Really big
2024,
duck dreams.
I have a plan of this is how I'm going to save more money next year to where I don't have to, like, worry about money while I'm on current unemployment.
Yeah, I mean, I'd just be happy for a job at this moment, but I guess the big dream is get a writing job, be a touring comic, be op somebody's opener. Like, all the big dreams are still true.
Put it out in that world. That's what these people who love to talk about zodiac signs say. If you say it, you're out in the world and it'll happen. Okay, but
Yeah, I mean, hopefully the right people are listening to this podcast and like, oh my gosh, you should be my opener.
well, I mean, is there any hopes of going back into journalism in any way, shape, or
Fuck
form?
no. No, I'm done. I mean, if it was like writing for The Daily Show, sure, or something to that effect, but I don't want to be a journalist anymore.
Okay, so that dream's dead, which is, that's great. Like, I don't fault for anybody who ends up quitting comedy if it makes them happier. You know, for me, if I quit this, if I quit comedy, I'm not, I know I'm not going to be happy. I know people who have kids who got wives and they're like, hey, look, my kid and my wife laugh at me and that's all I need. Nope. Mm-hmm. Not me. If I have a wife and a kid and it makes me stop doing comedy, all I'm going to say in my entire life is that I don't care if you laugh. I should have been making other people laugh. You're the one. Like,
right.
I know I'm going to be that resentful son of a bitch father. And that's why I use condoms. But like, it's, I'm not walking away from this industry anytime soon, but radio, which was my dream, you know, I'm fine with, they dismissed me from it. And if there's a radio station that comes a call in saying, hey, we want you to be the morning show host and we're going to pay you X amount of money and all this, it'd be a hard, but I have to give up everything else. Hard pressed. You know, I lived my dream. It didn't go as well as I wanted it to, but I made that chance. You know, now the next chance is stand up comedy. And I'm not at any shape or form giving that up. And I like to hear the same, you know, from you is like, this is your path and that's what you want. And you're happy with getting away from the past of getting past the dream you already had that you're like, don't need to be a news reporter anymore. So I'm glad to hear that.
Thank you. Yeah. And likewise for you, I think, there is a lot of bullshit in comedy too. There's bullshit in every industry, but you know what I love about comedy is that, like, yeah, like the job of being a reporter was different every day. Some days you're on a farm, some days you're at a shooting, some days you're at a mayor's rally.
By the way, that encapsulates the fact that you were a Baltimore journalist. Like, one day you're at a farm, one day you're at a shooting. Ah, that's Baltimore.
That is Baltimore County, Harford County.
That's Maryland in a nutshell.
For sure. But at the end of the day, I think, like, all the news is the fucking same. It doesn't matter what century you're living in or what city you're living in. There's greed and there's rich people, broken, corrupt people at the top trying to keep poor people and, like, regular, good, hardworking people down. And that is the crux of, like, every news story. Comedy changes every day. What people laugh at and where the line is changes every day. And that's really exciting for me. And I really enjoy the work. So I'm going to keep doing it.
Awesome. All right. This has been great. This was such a great, let's get to know each other episode podcast of somebody who has a very parallel path in life that I had. So it was great getting to know you, and hopefully we will soon, sometime this winter, I'm planning a trip to LA. Hopefully at the end of the year. So hopefully when I'm there, we get to do shows together and we get to confirm that we both do in fact have legs.
Yes, that is the most important thing, the biggest takeaway here. Thank you for having me. You, by the way, a lot of people have asked me questions about, like, my jump from news to comedy, but I think you did it the best because that you come from that background. I think you got, like, deeper into the subject matter and made it in a way that made me think about things I hadn't thought about before. So this was really fun for me.
I mean, honestly, I'm going to tell you, the question I hate is listening to other interviews is, so how did you become a comedian? I fucking despise that question. Like, every time I listen to, like, a friend of mine get on news, or even comedians that I do like listening to their interviews, or I've been lucky enough to interview some big name comedians, for newspaper and for radio and for my podcast, which, by the way, I've worked in newspapers and I've worked in radio. I am a single away from being the king of old dead media. I get it. But I want to get deep interviews. That's why I want people to have to think about their answers. I don't want stock answers. You know, more you think about your answer, the more I am happy with the question I ask myself. Now this is just me, you know, breaking my arm, patting myself on the back. Thank you for the compliment, but I like,
You did great. No, you did great. This was really fun for me.
Yeah. I mean, the best, if that's the second best compliment I've got during my podcast. And by the way, watch your feet. I'm name dropping was Jessica Kearson when I had her on.
I love Jessica
going like, you really are a good interviewer. I'm like, oh, thank you. Like, people should know.
I love Jessica. That's high praise.
Yeah. Oh, it is. And she doesn't give compliments willy nilly. So, and then, of course, when she was here in town, she had no interest in talking to me. But after the podcast, like, we've already had this conversation. You can go away now. But no, thank you so much for being on the pod. And, you know, the story that you tell, you know, your path, your journey was great here. So thanks so much.
Yeah. Thank you, Dennis. Take care.